Okay, good afternoon. I'd like to acknowledge my team member first, James River, Brittany Davis-Lowry, Emily Basker, Natasha Spasiani, Lee Zesko, Jessica Madrigal, and all of them are from the UIC Department of Disability and Human Development, Center for Health Promotion Research for Persons with Disabilities. Oh, I see. I have no relationship to disclose, and I also would like to acknowledge the funding source for this study, which is the U.S. Department of Education and National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. The health surveillance program can measure the burden of disease, identify population at risk, and recognize newer emerging health concerns. It also can monitor trends across years. And for the service side, it can guide the planning, implementation, and evaluation of programs to prevent and control disease and injury and adverse exposure, such as obesity. It also helps prioritize the allocation of the health resources. Despite the attention frequently given to the national data, it is the state government that has the key responsibility in providing services to its residents. A state-level surveillance programs that can monitor and track the health status of its residents can assist state government in highlighting the divergence across states which is not available from the national aggregated national data, and also in developing and implementing unique health policies and programs that can meet the need of its residents who are at risk. So the purpose of the present study is to identify the state-level surveillance programs that address obesity and its risk factors in high school students with disabilities. While there are a number of studies reporting the adult with disabilities are more obese than those without disabilities, there is a relatively limited number of studies on obesity among children with disabilities, particularly at population level. Children with disabilities part of the national trend of increasing childhood obesity? What are the risk factors related to their obesity status? As a part of larger study addressing these questions, we explored the availability of existing state-level surveillance programs that can be used in monitoring childhood obesity in high school students with disabilities. Methodologies. Sampling Universe is the state-level health surveillance programs using high school students with student as a respondent, and it's been administered between 2001 and 2010, and include questions related to the presence or absence of disability in student responders, and also weight and height information of the student. I'm going to talk about the result, and before talking about in detail of the result, I just want to mention this is still preliminary. We are trying to get in touch with the state officials to confirm our findings, but we are still in the process. So if you think we are missing something, some information is still not correct, I really appreciate if you can let us know. Across 50 states, we identified 55 surveillance programs. And for the following five states, we found two programs each: Georgia, Massachusetts, Michigan, Ohio, and Oregon. Among these 55 surveillance programs, there are 232 single-year surveys were administered between 2001 and 2010. Of those, 45, which is about 80%, were part of Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System, YRBSS, which is a school-based survey for students grades 9 to 12, and implemented jointly by CDC and state every other year. And the YRBSS addressed the following six areas of the health areas, which they think is very important for high school students: injury and violence, tobacco use, substance use, sexual behavior, nutrition, and physical activity. The YRBS also included self-reported weight and height information as a part of its questionnaire. Across 55 surveillance programs, 10 programs included a question or questions that identifies if the respondent has a disability. I want to go briefly over this table just to highlight the divergency of the programs in terms of their sampling target, interval of the survey being implemented, and also its content. On the top is the California Healthy Kids Survey. It's an annual high school-based survey for grades 7, 9, 11. And it addressed their resiliency and protective factors and risk behaviors, such as the relationship between teacher and student, or relationship of the student with other adults, and student school involvement or participation. I have already described the YRBS, so I'm going to skip Massachusetts YRBS and move on to the Massachusetts Youth Health Survey. This is a survey, biannual survey, also school-based, for students grades 9 to 12, and they just started 2007 to supplement YRBS. Some of the example questions included in Massachusetts Youth Health Survey is about sexual orientation, such as gays and lesbians, which were not included as a part of the YRBS questions. Minnesota Student Survey is also a school-based survey administered every 3 years for grades 8, 6, 9, and 12. And the questions are on experience and behavior and activities of the student. North Carolina has a YRBS, North Dakota used YRBS, and the Ohio Youth Survey. This is a one-time pilot study implemented in 2008 for grades 6 to 12 at 18 junior and senior high schools, and addressing the risk-taking behavior, attitude, activity, and personal strengths of the student. Oregon Healthy Teen Survey. This is the annual survey for grades 8 and 11. And it incorporated questions from YRVS and the Student Drug Use Survey. And starting last year, 2010, they shifted the implementation of the Healthy Teen Survey from annual to biannual. Rhode Island also has the YRVS and Washington Healthy Youth Survey. It's also a biannual school survey for grade 8, 10, and 12. And Form B focuses on the nutrition and physical activity, injury, and mental health. And if you wonder, Form A addresses substance abuse. This table summarizes 10 surveillance programs that include disability questions or questions broken down by the year of implementation. Double circle in the table represent the survey includes both disability question and weight and height information in a given year. The three squares on 2001 and 2004 Minnesota Student Survey and Ohio Youth Survey 2008, it means that the survey included the disability question, but they didn't ask weight and height information to the student. all years of the California Healthy Kids Survey on the top, and 2006, 2010 Washington Healthy Survey on the bottom, you will see the asterisks I added, which means which means they didn't ask the presence of the disability directly to the student, but they included disability as one of the potential reasons for harassment or bullying which students experienced. So these data are likely to underestimate the number of students who has a disability. Also, the Ohio Youth Survey 2008 data has a limited generalizability as geographically limited pilot program. Table shows that overall, 37 single-year surveys asked students about their disability status. Excluding three single-year surveys shown in square, that which didn't collect the students' weight and height information, 34 single-year surveys shown in double circles collected the obesity data for students with disabilities. And just as a cautionary note, that the disability question being used are very different from surveillance program to surveillance program, and even in the same surveillance program, across the years, they change the questions. So the comparison of the data across states or across years requires some caution. This and the following nine slide graphically shows that the availability of the weight and height data of high school students for each year between 2001 to 2010, described in the previous slide. For each year, the state implemented its surveillance program. States that collected weight and height information on students with and without disability were shown in green, and states that collected the data only on students without disability are shown in blue. States that did not implement any surveillance in given year or did not collect weight and height information are shown in white. After I came here, I noted that the Minnesota 2001, 2004, and Ohio 2008 should be shown in white because they didn't collect the weight and height information, but it's mistakenly incorrectly shown in the blue. So for each slide, for each given year, I put some collection note at the bottom of the slides. Okay, let's start. 2001, 2, 3, 4, please consider Minnesota as a white state. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
How many minutes do
you have?
Two minutes? Okay. I have only 2 minutes to go, so I'm going to go very quickly for the following slides and jump on the conclusion. Next two slides shows what kind of physical activity and nutrition information each of these nine surveillance programs collect. This slide shows the physical activity component. Basically said, the physical activity guideline information, such as how many days students exercise more than 60 minutes per day, and also sedentary activity information, such as how many hours they are watching TV, playing games, or doing computer or Nintendos, are very frequently available. However, the active transportation participation, which is if the student walk or bike to the school, or extracurricular physical activity things, such as if the student exercised off the school or during the weekend, these information are much less available for students with disabilities. And this is the same thing about the nutrition. Fruits and vegetables information are mostly available, as well as the sugary drink intake. However, the information about high-fat, high-calorie foods, such as if they eat fried potatoes or use the fast food restaurants, are very much less available for students with disabilities.
How many minutes to go?
One.
Okay. Skipping the summary and jumping on the discussion. In the previous studies listed here, they found the high obesity among the high school students likely to be higher than students without disabilities. And in light of these findings, we think that high school students with disabilities are much more likely to be obese than those without. The absence of population-level data on obesity and its risk factors in high school students with disability in the majority of 50 states demonstrated in the present study may limit states' ability to respond to emerging health needs of this population promptly, considering they are in a transition period and moving into the adult world, and knowing the findings that obese child likely to become obese adult, I think the need for intervention is very intense. So to avoid this, I think, you know, we should do the better job to collect the data to support the policy initiative. And I don't have the time, so let me leave you my last comment. What gets measured gets done. So if we are concerned about your childhood obesity, data should be there. Thank you.
Thank you, Kiyoshi. So we heard some wonderful presentations pointing us to the need for better data, better policy, more evidence-based practice, and improvements to access to healthcare and quality access to healthcare. So thank you very much. We have, let's see, it's 3:44, so we have about 16 minutes for questions. I'm going to Dr. Theory and then Dr. Smeltzer. Let me bring around a...
I have questions for the first two speakers, but really appreciate your presentations and appreciate that, the hearing about the high prevalence rate of falls among people with disabilities. I guess my question has to do with what are the next steps and whether or not any of the evidence-based practices that are out there to prevent falls have actually been applied to targeted groups of people with disabilities.
To my knowledge, and again, I'm speaking from a very Massachusetts-centric, that the evidence-based practices haven't been applied. They have, and this is something else, I talked about another study that I'm working on where we're looking at people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and the rate of falls and fall injuries using administrative data. And we're actually looking, to see, because AHRQ has these evidence-based practices, and we see if we can actually look into modifying them for certain populations. But, really that's the reason for doing this analysis. I mean, there's a huge gap in that. And you know that well.
I was traveling somewhere, I can't remember where, and I remember hearing somebody say that the only thing left to do with fall prevention is translation. And I was like, well, wait a minute. I don't think so. But it's kind of good to see that you have these data that support that, and maybe we need to start thinking about, now that we know this, what next?
Right.
And how do we make that happen?
And the other piece is the community-based piece of it. The analysis that we did for the BRFSS is community-based. The analysis that we're doing with the IDDD population is in day programs, residential programs. So they really complement each other in many ways, and it's the same.
Dr. Zhang, do you have anything to add?
Yeah. In injury epidemiology, we have at least three goals to achieve. Number one is to identify whether the injury risk is higher or lower. I think it's very clear injury risk among individuals with disabilities is high. There's no doubt about that. And the second question is, second thing we need to do is to identify patterns of those injuries. We identify false events are the number one priorities. But still, I have some unclear uncertainties about where did this falls happened, and So I think we still have a lot of work to do to really investigate those faults and then find out the effective ways to prevent these faults. The third part is I encourage my colleagues in intervention programs to work together with us to develop those intervention programs. Really, as the injury epidemiology, we want to achieve the first and the second, but we want to work together with our colleagues in other disciplines to design interventions. So.
Thank you. I'll just add that in terms of the fall prevention program in Montana, we're rolling out Stepping On, which is the evidence-based program for fall prevention, and exclusion criteria will cover people who can't walk, I think it's more than 50 yards on their own. So that whole evidence-based practice was developed for people and is designed on strengthening. So the facilitators are guiding physical activity, and they don't really have some of the skills that inclusive fitness trainers might have. They don't have the ability to adapt the physical activity components of that curricula for people with physical disabilities. And like Dr. Zhang is pointing out, that may not be the protective factor that needs to be built to prevent falls with people with physical disabilities. So there is a lot of work to be done. And then I will just make my plug for the environment and point out the number of falls that happen on stairs and steps.
Suzanne Smeltzer from Villanova. Let me add another element since we're talking about falls. We have done some research, and I know a lot of other people have as well, pointing out the high incidence of osteopenia and osteoporosis in people with disabilities. And so, you know, one intervention strategy should target, obviously, falls, but I think another one needs to target assessment for risk for osteoporosis and prevention of osteoporosis. So I don't know if you care to comment on that.
I agree with you. I think that's absolutely right. And I, you know, also what Dr. Zhang says, there's a lot more that needs to be done in terms of assessment, in terms of looking where the falls are occurring in the environment, but totally agree with you.
I appreciate your comment. Injury risk among individuals with disability, it's a new research direction. There are a lot of things we need to do. So we definitely encourage input from our colleagues. So.
A quick question. Because you mentioned assistive technology, did you have the ability to look to see if the interaction between an assistive device, a walker or a wheelchair, contributed to the fall, given that access is very limited when you're using a walker or a wheelchair in a lot of communities despite the ADA? For example, it's very easy to fall walking down the street simply because there's a bump in the sidewalk that's not supposed to be there.
In the analysis that I did, I couldn't, because we didn't have a question specifically on whether the respondent used a wheelchair or assistive mobility device. However, there are a couple of articles looking at falls and fall injuries among wheelchair users, and I think one of the things actually they looked at the environmental piece. One of the places that the falls was actually occurring the most was that their very own homes were inaccessible. This was a population of veterans. I can forward you the article later. But it's really where actually their homes were inaccessible. So you know, either had one step or two steps, and that's where the falls were occurring.
We don't have that data at this moment, so that's something probably we can do that with suggestions.
Other questions? I just wanted to follow up with Dr. Zhang. In terms of outcomes of falls, we've talked about injuries, but people with disabilities who experience injuries might also, living in a smaller margin of health, that injury may be more severe and may actually cause people to leave their job. Are you able to talk about that at all?
No, I don't have that data. So one thing we can do, we can build a cohort, use the MAPS data, so to try to see what their outcomes after the falls, whether they are still employed in the workplace. So, good question. So, I don't have that data. So.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Otherwise, I have one more for Kiyoshi. So I think one of our challenges is to integrate disability screeners into these surveillance programs that you've identified. And I will say Montana has a disability screener in the YRBS since 2000. And but what we've seen in terms of our challenge of interpreting the data is it's school control who is included in the actual survey completion. So how do we support the inclusion of students with disabilities in providing data through these surveillance systems? Do you have some comments?
Yes, that was listed for the slide, which I skipped for the sake of time. Lots of the high school-based survey doesn't seem to be providing any accommodation for students with disability who needs such kind of assistance to participate. So that providing them more accommodation is one way of doing. I also think that working with the BRFSS, which has the two disability question consistently included as a standard core questionnaire, probably it will help if the CDC and YRBS both pushed to include the similar questions as a part of the core questionnaires. Lots of the states who added the disability question or did it by their own this question, and it doesn't seem to be standardized and uniformly implemented. So knowing that the YRBS has a huge presence in the high school based surveillance program, I think if the push from CDC will help. I also think another alternative, probably oversampling of students with disabilities through the special education cooperative, it's called Special Ed Corps in Illinois, could help. So these are the three things which I thought may be helpful.
Terrific. Does anybody have anything to add to that conversation?
I actually.
Thank you.
I think one of the things about accommodations, which is very tricky, because I've worked in the Massachusetts Health Survey for a long time. Massachusetts YRBS actually does not have a disability screener. It has a question of whether the person has an IEP or not, which is very different from having a disability screener. And I know that because we fought long and hard with the YRBS to get the screeners on. But one of the accommodations is a difficult because the YRBS asks very, very touchy, very sensitive questions, including sexual violence, the last time, they had any sexual activity, et cetera. So to actually have proxy respondents of people actually helping students that is very difficult. So I think it's sort of hard on how to balance the two.
Can I comment?
Yes.
Thanks for getting the attention to my Massachusetts YRBS. I remember, if I remember correctly, they have the IE asking students IEP for a few years, then they switch to the asking more functional limitation thing. No? Okay, that's what I will check about. Another comment I have is, as I work on this surveillance program, I noticed that, though I encountered several literatures that among the school people, asking of this seems to be considered as taboo. At least some of the folks at works at the school think it's not a good idea to ask students how much you weigh and how tall you were, because their argument is, the students may be stigmatized and by being identified he or she is obese. And I heard, according to the literature I reviewed, there's not many obesity-based surveillance going on in the States, mainly because of this resistance from the school people and probably from some parents and other people who are in the public health and looking into the consequences of obesity, and particularly in adults as well as children. I think this is sad, and probably we should start addressing this with the school community.
Thank you, Kiyoshi, and I do think that is looking upstream from some of the data that Amanda presented in terms of the adult rates of diabetes, trying to intervene early with children with disabilities in terms of obesity and nutrition is really important. Thank you to all the presenters. Any other questions before I close up? One more comment. Thank you.
Actually, this is just a quick question for Amanda. For the people, were people in your sample dual eligible? I was just wondering if for people who you didn't find any Medicaid claims for their diabetes care, whether they would have, you know, had Medicare or other sources of insurance where?
We did include dual eligibles in there. But we did. We also have crossover claims.
You do. Okay.
So it should have shown up. But that is a possibility. It's a good point you raised. But it is a possibility. I mean, we don't have any way to check that.
Right.
Because we don't have the Medicare claim, so we don't really know how accurate the crossover claims are. So that's a really good point you raised. But I should go back and check that 7% to see if they were all duals or if they were the mixture. Or
right. It just occurred to me as a possible explanation.
Yeah, that's
for
a really
that
good question.
Lack of
I'll check that out.
Claims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question.
Terrific. Thank you. I was just struck by one other challenge that we've had in the schools in terms of including students with disabilities that have come to us through No Child Left Behind. And there have been a lot of wonderful work on the part of our colleagues in special education on how we accommodate students with disabilities to participate in the standardized testing that might be a literature we look to in terms of expanding our ability to include students with disabilities in public health survey work. So thank you for bringing this topic to us. And the final thing I want to point you to is what's next on the program. We have two presentations, sessions highlighted in the program for the disability section between 4:30 and 6. One is outside of the disability section, but it is relevant to our work. It's entitled Let's Work Together, Participatory Planning to Build Sustainable Communities and Reach Environmental Justice. And that is in Renaissance Meeting Room 13. The disability section will host a session very much following up on Dr. Zhang's presentation, Approaches to Improve Employment Outcomes Among Persons with Disabilities. I encourage you to stay for that in 103A right here. And at 6:30, I encourage you, invite you to join us for the disability section business meeting. That is at 6:30 in 207A. And that is where you will hear what the disability section has been up to from the Executive Council, and it's also an opportunity for us to honor our award recipients this year for the Student Achievement Award, the Alan Myers Award, our first advocacy award from the disability section, and our student scholarship travel recipients, and is there any other? I think that's all the awards that we're presenting this evening. So thank you, everybody.